You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 252 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual. It's a full year of it now. From different locations, I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. It's the Sloan edition!
We're not really doing anything
virtual
Sloan-related.
Sloan! Here we go! Charts! Graphs! Virtually!
It would be pretty fun if I started displaying charts on the video.
Is that Nate Duncan's music?
I love your Sloan references. What else do you have here?
Oh, God. The guy who makes the charts. This is everything that I know.
Kirk Goldsberry.
Goldsberry! Virtual Once Kirk left, Goldsberry's hotel room.
Once left the... He was going to the original shot charts when he did his first presentation. Mm-hmm. The first time he presented at Sloan. He was going to bring them back home with him on his plane, but left them in the bar that night.
Oh, there we go.
I do remember that one. There's your inside Sloan talk.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was thinking the other night with the NBA All-Star Game was Sunday, which is not normally this time of the year. And I was thinking that after I finished doing my traditional grades of the participants of the All-Star Game, there were two places I wanted to be that was not my living room. One of those was media hospitality after the All-Star Game.
It's a pretty good hospitality.
It's the price is great. The company is great. The food is often quite good as well. Free drinks. I mean, you know, what more can you ask for? Or the Fours, because that's where it would usually be the spot during Sloan weekend. But sadly, the Four is a classic sports bar. SI called it the number one sports bar in America, closed down permanently.
Wow.
One of the things we have lost during this pandemic.
Ouch. We lost Great Scott and the Fours. Boston is struggling.
Well, we're not here to talk about Boston. We're here to talk about Seattle. And let's start with our beer from right here in Seattle, which is for the second week in a row, we're going to two beers. And this time we have a beer that I'm sure I've had before, but I don't know that I can specifically remember it. The Two Beers Pilsner, but I thought it was a good time to do it along with the other Coast Hazy IPA we did last week, which I guess would have been more appropriate for this week now that I think about it. Because of the fact that they rebranded the Pilsner, new cans, and they are very sharp looking, I have to say.
There we go. Why would this have been better for this week? What is your...
Because Hazy IPA, the other Coast, Boston, would have fit in with the Sloan theme.
You didn't know that was the theme until right now.
You had hinted at it previously. Anyways, about the Pilsner, our award-winning Pilsner, based on a traditional Czech pale lager recipe, is hopped with the classic Saz hops and our own edition of Pearl hops. With a lightly sweet aroma and mild hop spiciness on the tongue, it's a refreshing take on an old style.
All right, let's go.
Speaking, by the way, of a refreshing take on an old style, I had some Pagliacci last night for the first time in a while.
How was that?
Did the salame picante with the salumi, rosemary's, salami, and I think sweet peppers, which lived up to the name. They were very sweet peppers. That was quite good.
These are the Mama's Little Sweet Peppers?
No, I don't think they're those specifically.
Because that's what they have on another pie, on the spicy chicken, I believe.
Maybe they are. Now that I'm not sure about it.
That sounds great, though.
Indeed it was. All right, to our toasts. Well, first off, I should mention, by the way, a tradition that we did not have last year because of the cancellation of the NCAA tournament is our annual Pelton Cast NCAA tournament bracket challenges on ESPN, which are returning for the men's and women's NCAA tournaments. And you can sign up now, although obviously you still have next week to sign up until the tournaments tip off, which is not, I feel All like right. It's a different day now. I think that's a thing. All right, to the actual
toast. What's going on?
The tournaments are on a different day, I think. Like the first four is on Thursday now. I'll have to look this up. But I think that's a thing.
Okay.
To our actual toast, the 2021 Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame finalists were announced Tuesday on The Jump, and there are several with Seattle ties, most notably three-time WNBA MVP Lauren Jackson, who played her entire WNBA career with the Storm.
There we go.
She's a no-brainer Hall of Famer. It's a little unclear why she wasn't on the ballot last year, because that would have been the appropriate amount of time, it seemed, based on her retirement, but she, again, should be an easy pick this year. One of the greatest players in women's basketball history, without question. Also, Yolanda Griffith, who was Jackson's teammate for the Storm in 2008. We've got former Sonics coach Bill Russell is a coach.
I was going to say, Bill Russell.
He got in as a player, you know, a few years back.
They're later on that than an email from the Vera Project.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Look, I always know it's almost time for me to record when I see that in my inbox. And lastly, former Sonics color analyst Marcus Johnson is a finalist. Is a player, yes.
All right. Is that like the Veterans Committee, or is this normally voted in the same way anybody else would be?
Same way anybody else would be. So similar to, you know, Jack Sikma was eligible, picked a few years ago in a year where there weren't any, I think, recent NBA players, certainly not any first timers back in 2019 when he went into the hall. But, you know, he was more or less a contemporary. I think he played with Marcus Johnson in Milwaukee, I'm pretty sure. All right, next up. To Sue Bird, who was among the four prominent female athletes to co-found together a media and commerce company aiming to tell the stories of female athletes while also covering the convergence of sports, culture, activism, and lifestyles. The star-studded group also includes Alex Morgan of the U.S. Women's National Team and Olympic gold medalists Chloe Kim and Simone Manuel. So very cool. Then next up, three members of the Seattle Kraken's front office were named in Sportsnet's 25 Most Powerful Women in Hockey this year. Obviously, Director of Hockey Strategy and Research Alex Mandricki was number four on the list, with Pro Scout Cami Granato and Senior Quantitative Analyst Namita Nandakumar jointly placed number 21. And then to UW softball, Gabby Plain was named Pac-12 Pitcher of the Week for the third time in 4 weeks of the 2021 season. Very similar to Zion Tupuola-Fatui's domination of the Pac-12 Football Defensive Player of the Year Award early in the season. Plain struck out 17 and allowed just three base runners and one run in 8 1/3 innings. That one run did snap a 25 2/3 inning scoreless streak with her on the mound. And then outfielder Sammy Reynolds was the Pac-12 Hitter of the Week on the strength of 8 for 11 at the plate, with two home runs and 11 RBI in last week's three-game sweep of Hawaii.
There we go. 17 strikeouts.
Yeah.
I mean, this is shaping up to be, I guess we'll talk more about Husky softball later. This is shaping up to be a monster season from Gabby Plain, though.
I mean, again, she's one at three of the four, and the other week she was named by one outlet the National Pitcher of the Week. So she's doing some big things.
There we go.
Granted, not really tested yet, so we'll see what happens when the schedule gets a little more difficult in Pac-12 play. But more on UW softball later. For now, I think it's time to turn our attention to our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, which took us last Saturday to Frank's Oyster House and Champagne Parlor. Because it's Ravenna, but it's really right near U Village. So that's what I think of it as.
I made the same joke to Mrs. Fantasy Genius that there's no sex in Frank's Oyster House and Champagne Parlor.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad. Opened in 2009 as the second restaurant for Felix and Sarah Penn, who also run Pear 3 blocks away. Right now, the menus have been consolidated at Frank's during the pandemic, which is named for Sarah's grandfather, who introduced her to the reliable pleasures of dining out at Boston area eateries. They describe themselves as contemporary homage to gracious American dining. So this is a little fancier, I think, than our usual stops in our search, is a little more upscale.
Gracious American dining.
You're not a term I've run across.
And you invoked Boston also.
That was fitting, yes.
Sloan edition. This was an interesting one, and one that I was curious to try. I was curious to try both the chicken and then also just kind of the meal in general. In particular, having some of the oysters as well. You were like, do you want to get oysters? And I was like, I guess. And you're like, we're going to Frank's Oyster House. And it's like, oh, yes, definitely we need oysters. If you're going to Frank's Oyster House, you can't not get oysters and just, I'll have the chicken, right?
We did not get champagne, though, despite the champagne parlor part of it.
That's even stranger, champagne parlor. But, I don't know if I've developed my palate enough to sit and just casually enjoy a fine champagne. But who knows? I'm still young. So I was curious to try this one just because I feel like it is pretty far outside of, you know, most of the locations that we've been to on the search, some of which have been strictly chicken places, others of which have been a little bit more fast casual type locations. You know, so this one was an outlier in a couple of different ways. And what we ended up getting was there was like a meal for two, right? So it's a full meal rather than just choosing out different types of chicken or whatever. So it included, I think you said, 8 pieces of chicken.
Yep.
8 pieces of chicken. There was some like cooked cauliflower, which I thought was quite excellent. Mashed potatoes. Yeah, that's
apparently from the pear menu. And that was quite good. Yes.
Mashed potatoes, salad, a biscuit. And what am I missing in there?
That was it for the meal. Yeah. 2 biscuits. I obviously took one of them and left you one for you.
So, you know, it was a full meal that you're getting. When I laid everything out on the plate, and then we also got some fried oysters as well. When I laid everything out on the plate, it was like, this is a nice looking plate of food here, you know, which is a little bit different than some of the chicken we've had in as much as that it's mostly just chicken, right? It's chicken and sides. This was a full meal in a way. And, you know, I saved the chicken mostly for last. Came with a couple of different sauces. There was sort of the oyster sauce, right? The like orange oyster sauce, a little bit tangy, right? And I did use that to dip some of the chicken in. And I just kept coming back to this theme of, oh, and a gravy that went with the mashed potatoes.
Correct.
All of the flavors that we had when eating this, I would describe as muted, right?
Interesting.
And it wasn't, not even necessarily in a bad way. It's very subtle when it comes to flavor on pretty much every item. And these are probably should be, I guess most of them are not the most flavorful foods, but it was like the gravy even was very muted, right? It wasn't too rich. It wasn't too spicy, right? It was just everything I feel like was like brought down a notch as far as flavor goes. And Mrs. Fantasy Genius even described it as British in a way. You know, it's almost the exact opposite of, it just wasn't, there wasn't a lot of spice to it. And there weren't a lot of overwhelming flavors. But at the same time, you know, everything was very nicely done. Like, I enjoyed the entire experience of eating it. It just, there wasn't anything that flavor-wise jumped out from kind of that neutrality of everything that was on the plate. And that includes the chicken and the oysters.
So I think the thing that jumped out to me when I first got the food and was driving back to my house is, you know, I was going through the boxes to make sure that everything was in there. And I was like, huh, that's odd. For an 8-piece fried chicken, there's not a very large box in here. And so it seems like the explanation is it wasn't like your traditional wings and thighs and legs and breast. It was almost more deconstructed in a way, I would say, where, you know, like there was a chunk of breast that was fried up in there, but no bones. Mm-hmm. Notably. And then, you know, kind of what would have been the wing was mostly just fried, basically, as opposed to having the bone in there because it wasn't in there. Was that your experience as well?
I don't know if I had anything that resembled a wing, so I don't know if I could really speak to that specifically. But it was almost like they weren't chicken strips because they weren't in strip form, but it was just boneless chicken chunks. Boneless, yes. Chicken pieces. Which I'm not sure if it's the best way to cook a chicken. There's obviously a value to a chicken strip, but sometimes the bones are an important piece to have rather than kind of like oblong shapes of chicken.
I mean, to me, the big thing was that, you know, you had bites where it was basically all the breading, all the fried part of it.
I don't know if I had that.
I definitely did. And you want that quality ratio of meat to breading.
What did you think of the oysters?
I thought the oysters were average, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They were good.
I would probably not recommend people get them given the price point for the oysters, which is funny to go. My recommendation at Frank's Oyster House is not to get the oysters.
It just all of the different pieces. It was like nothing was bad. You know, this wasn't, you know, I keep coming back to the Ethan Stoll chicken, where in hindsight, it kind of ended up tasting worse, the ESR chicken. And this wasn't that. There was nothing bad about this meal at all. I thoroughly enjoyed it, right? Like, I enjoyed eating basically every single part of this meal, but nothing stood out from the pack. And we're having a conversation here about Seattle's best fried chicken. And I just don't feel like this is really a competitor, really would be in that conversation.
Agreed with that. And I would say, like, the breast piece I had was really quite good. But the other part, I would say the chicken was, it wasn't the standout of the meal. I mean, if I'm remembering anything from the meal, it's probably going to be the cauliflower.
The cauliflower, so, yeah. It was good.
So yeah. I scored an 82.
I had it exactly an 82 also.
Wow. We are in lockstep here. Can I nominate a location for next week?
Of course.
Because obviously we almost never go to the place we say on the podcast. Yes. We are going to go the following
You said we were going to go to Frank's Oyster House and Champagne Parlor.
I mean, I had this planned out because this was like my one weekend of there are not NBA games on at night. So I've been doing a lot of going out to restaurants for dinner, which is a different experience that I've had for a few months here. And so one of the places I went, in addition to Frank's and Pagliacci, was Mangosteen, which I went to get the chicken sandwich either November or December. I know it was some point close to the solstice because I remember that I went at about the same time of night that I went today, and it was pitch black and pouring rain and just kind of a miserable experience, even though the food was great. This time it was like
that
the
could
sun
have been
was
many
setting.
Months in Seattle.
Fair,
for the record.
Fair, but I went at like six. Is so yeah. It was. It's definitely
that changes nothing.
Yeah, it does not change much. But it is notable that now I can go at six and have to. The thing I have to deal with is the sunset driving west to get to.
Just wait till next week.
I'm very excited about next week. That's a thing that often sometimes happens in conjunction with Sloan is the time change, and I think it did last year, but not this year. So anyways, I went there to get the chicken sandwich, which you'll recall that last year of all the new chicken sandwiches we tried was my favorite.
Wow.
And still remains quite good, but there was an important discovery.
Best new chicken sandwich.
Well, there was like a bunch of new chicken sandwiches that popped up, including Cookies, which we obviously love Cookies chicken, but I did not think their chicken sandwich was as good as Mangosteen's. Great, that was earlier.
That's true. That was in the Pelton Casty Awards.
You know, I want to do Seattle's Best of Awards as opposed to just the searches for one specific thing.
And you want to hand them out actual
no,
sheets or whatever, and so that we can
yeah, you
got to
mail
them
out.
Give them to the business owners and be like, "What the fuck do I do with this thing?" Be
you
like,
got to make sure that they display it. I mean,
can
come
we
on,
throw this away?
What incredible honor to have the famous Cousin Katie Photoshop an award for you, a certificate that says your Seattle's best new fried chicken sandwich.
That's a category in the Pelton Kesty Awards.
But anyways, there was something important.
Okay.
When I went to go to Mangosteen, which as we've talked before, is in the boat by Pho Bac in the parking lot there. I looked at the menu that they have posted.
You think it's
on the
pronounced
window.
Pho Bac, not Pho Bac?
I don't know. We went over this last time. I thought that's where we landed, but I don't remember anymore. As opposed to the menu that I was ordering from online, the menu that they had posted there showed chicken strips.
Oh,
so
really?
Mangosteen is a contender.
Wow.
For Seattle's best fried chicken. And you still have not been there, even though I've been there twice. And we need to change that. You need to go.
All right. Sounds good. They not only want to have that award for Seattle's best new chicken sandwich, they're also looking for the award for Seattle's best fried chicken next week on the Pelton Cast.
Look, when it's an official search, I feel like that's got to be a trophy of some sort, not just a certificate. I don't know what exactly.
We can award ourselves the trophy.
Anyways, I'm quite excited for that. Should we turn our attention to sports?
Sure. Of course. I'm still kind of thinking about this trophy, to be honest.
I mean, it's got to be a giant P, right? It's got to be the logo.
A giant
P. Maybe with the chef's hat on it. I don't know.
Where in Oink do you think they would display that?
I mean, that Oink's a pretty small location. It's going to be tougher for them than some of these
like,
other
just,
places.
It's going to permanently need one of your chairs. I know you have 12 chairs. This giant P that you've been awarded is going to need one.
How big a sculpture are you thinking here? I was thinking like, you know, maybe like 6 inches. Maybe 8.
Oh, no. I mean, if you go big or go home, we need at least solid 6 feet.
Several feet tall?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Let's just try to take the Rainier R and knock off the one leg and make it the Beltencast P and give that as the trophy.
That's pretty good. I like that.
It's not, though, because the Rainier R is iconic. We need to make sure it stays where it belongs. Let's start out with our sports roundup and go through a few news items as well as a discussion dating back a couple of weeks. The Kraken announced that KJR will be their radio home starting in fall of 21.
This is a big one for KJR, right? Who have not won the rights to that many of the major Seattle sports recently, correct?
Well, they got UW sports back this current academic year. Just in time for that 3-game football season.
There we go.
And the men's basketball season where they won 4 games. Five
games. ING Sports Network.
But yes, professional sports, Seahawks and Mariners have exclusively been on ESPN Seattle.
Do you think that there was a conflict between the Mariners and the Kraken? Because during the springtime, they will overlap for, you know, quite a few months there, potentially.
I don't know if that would have prevented it. I mean, I'm sure ESPN was interested in doing it, but maybe that is a factor in why it's a better fit for KJR. Although then you run into, you know, men's basketball frequently overlapping with the Kraken. So I don't know who will win those competitions.
I do
suspect it'll be the Kraken.
I know who will win those competitions. Get ready for 8:50 a.m.
But they did sign the UW deal first, so I don't know if they've got any protection. The Huskies have any protection in that there. On the Mariners front, we got a question from Third Pelton brother Nate Taggart, going back to episode 250, where we talked about the fallout from Kevin Mather's resignation. And he asked, was the comment about T-Mobile Park's food scene in there having room to improve meant to imply that it ranks below Lumen Field? I've always thought that T-Mobile has been whooping on Lumen for quite some time. I feel like Lumen Field just recently started dipping its toes into the good stadium food world, but I think the gap to T-Mobile is still pretty wide. And he submitted his Seattle Stadium food rankings, which were 1, T-Mobile Park, 2, Lumen Field, 3, Key Arena. Sounds like Climate Pledge Arena will fix this disaster. A long drop-off, the number 4, Heck Ed, and then an even longer drop-off down to number 5, Husky Stadium, followed by number 6, Popcorn at Royal Rome Pavilion for the crossover. And then Third Pelton brother Nora Cohen chimed in to point out that the Kingdom Food ranked number 100 on this list, below getting struck by a fairy.
There's kind of nothing like, I think at the softball games, maybe Husky baseball, you can get a beer and take it back to your seats. I'm pretty sure they've actually opened that up at quite a few different events for you could do that at Husky basketball too.
Correct.
You just not football for whatever reason.
It sounds like there's going to be more availability of beer this year. If I recall an interview I saw with Jen Cohen at some point.
If there are games.
If I mean, yes.
There'll be games if there are fans of games. So I don't remember this comment. I don't think this came from me. This came from you, right?
I think it did. And specifically what I was thinking of by the room for improvement is not that the food there is bad. I mean, the Woody's. You got Din Tai Fung. Jack's Barbecue is still there, right?
That seems right.
It's been a while since I've been to a game, obviously. It's been a while since any of us have been to a game. But they had quality food offers, but I was specifically thinking back to a conversation on Twitter between friend of the pod, Eric Rivera, and Third Pelton brother, Isabel Menagian, who was part of our live show, where he was saying he would like to do food at T-Mobile Park, and that would be room for improvement.
So that's it. This is strictly just Eric Rivera. There was nothing to be implied that it's worse than any other location or any other stadium.
It wasn't a complaint. I mean, look, there's always room for improvement in your food offerings. Like, nobody's achieved perfection in this regard. But yeah, I definitely think now Lumen Field, obviously, Taco Time, like that's a big get right there. And
Taco Time was not going to be back, though, right? Didn't we have a conversation with Robbie Tonkin that he felt like Taco Time would not be back at Lumen Field?
I thought his expectation was that they were going to expand to a larger space.
Okay.
The last time we checked in on the state of Taco Time. Now, again, this was all a very long time ago. So many things have happened. Who knows what the state of food at Lumen Field in 2021 might be. Any of these places, it's really tough to say. But I do think T-Mobile Park has had the best food in Seattle for sure.
Look, when you're that bad, you have to compete really hard in every other area of what you're doing. If the product that you're putting out there is Mariners baseball, the food better be fucking delicious. So yeah, there's room to improve because you better be inching close to perfection. The Seahawks and Sounders, for that matter, haven't had to compete that hard at this. People are more focused on the sporting event at hand. I also think that there's a certain element of, look, you want to compete your hardest no matter what in anything that you're doing. But baseball is a sport that lends itself to eating casually more than football or soccer do. So I think that that's definitely part of it. Like, there are going to be more food offerings at any baseball stadium, but T-Mobile Park has done a very good job. You know, you walk around T-Mobile Park and there are tons of options. You're like, wow, I could have that. I could have that. I could have that. It's almost tough to even decide what you want to eat because there is so much good food there.
Agreed. Yeah. Which is a good problem to have. So to be clear, yeah, definitely not a shot at T-Mobile Park's food offerings in any way. I also, like, we can't really evaluate. I know the Kingdom food was terrible, but we were never allowed to eat it as kids.
No.
It was always, if we were going to pick up something at the Taco Bell Express at the gas station across the street.
That was the best stadium food there was. Wow, I forgot about that Taco Bell Express. So cheap, too. Like 79 cents for a soft taco.
I feel like Talkin' Taco Time co-host Randy Cote mentioned that at one point. I feel like that, or someone mentioned it at some point recently. It's come up.
Man, I don't think I have any better memories of sport. It's like number two is the double, or at least Mariners baseball. Number two is the double, and number one is the Taco Bell Express across the street from the Kingdom. Oh, man, was that great.
Oh, dear.
It was like in a gas station, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember sometimes getting Subway on 4th Avenue on the way to the game. That was a treat when we went with our uncle because of the fact that we could actually eat something a little higher quality. Mm-hmm. Not to imply that Taco Bell is not high quality.
Or Subway seemed like high quality food.
Well, it seemed like it was a much different thing.
The 90s were a long time ago.
And that was like the mid-90s. By the end of the 90s, I was eating Subway for lunch a lot in high school. So there was a discussion of whether we should have searches for Seattle's best stadium/arena food. And that'll be something interesting to visit this fall if we're able to, especially if, you know, Climate Pledge Arena is in the mix with all new food options. Because it will not be hard to upgrade over Key Arena's food option. Key Arena, I'm sure at some point I ate the concession stand food, but...
They never really had. I here's what I'll say for Key Arena.
They did briefly have Ivers and Kid Valley, and I think I may have had that at one point.
But they kind of missed out when they had a tenant like the Sonics. You know, when they had a major tenant in there who was playing 40 plus nights a year, they missed out on the era of good food in stadiums, and it didn't really start until probably around 2010 or so was when I think things really took off for that. And basketball was obviously gone. So, you know, it was just in pretty much every way, Key Arena was a relic of the 90s. And the food was a huge part of that. You know, it was like there would be in the third quarter, there's the little like kid stand where you could get a dollar hot dog.
Oh, yeah. I definitely ate that. Yeah, I should say I definitely ate that as a fan.
And Jan was definitely all about that dollar hot dog, right? She'd go over there and get like three or four of them.
Oh, there was also there was an opening night where they threw back the concession stand prices to, like, it was like the 35th anniversary or whatever it was. I remember eating a lot that night. This also reminds me of when the Sounders did the all-inclusive food in the 200 level.
And they don't do that anymore, right? Do they have
no.
They have no all-inclusive sections. It just really kind of just distracts you from the sport at hand, I feel like.
Right. Definitely a much better baseball thing.
But also Diamond Club.
Yeah, I mean, that's that on a much different scale.
Not really competing. That's my hope for fans coming back for baseball this year. Like, if I could just be in Diamond Club at one point for this baseball season, I'll be fine. I don't need to go into any other baseball games.
I gotta say, I haven't seen any specific updates on this, but it seems likely that some attendance for Mariners games and whenever, you know, when the Sounders start, will be approved. I mean, we've even seen California allowing fans at, you know, opening day and their various ballparks. So
interesting.
You know, Chicago announced it today that there will be fans at the Cubs and White Sox game. So these are places that have been similarly cautious to Seattle that are starting to open things back up, at least with outdoor events.
And I would consider myself to be on a pretty extreme level of caution. And even like when watching even football games in the fall, it's like, this doesn't look that dangerous. What's going on here? You know, with the amount of fans that they've had and being outdoors, it's, I don't know if it's something that I would do personally, but I don't look at it as, you know, this isn't fucking Greg Abbott or whatever happening. Like, this isn't a complete failure of government. So I think that I would be in favor of that.
Yeah, I think it makes sense at this point. Let's talk about the Sounders because we have a homecoming.
Hello.
You're the Skylar Gray. Freddie Montero is back.
There we go.
Sounders all-time leading scorer with 60 goals across all competitions played in Seattle. The Sounders' first four MLS seasons, making two All-Star appearances and scoring the first goal in franchise history. I think we're coming up on the anniversary of that. Most recently was with the Vancouver Whitecaps, is a designated player the last two seasons, had 5 goals and 2 assists in 16 matches in 2020 after scoring 8 in 32 matches in 2019, signed a 1-year deal with the Sounders with 2 team options. Seems like it could be an indication the Sounders plan to go to a 2-man front line is a more common formation this season, as Brian Schmetzer has indicated, would be possible with the loss of Jordan Morris on the wing. With Montero joining Will Bruin alongside Raul Ruiz Diaz, Sounders now have enviable depth at forward.
And so where is Freddie Montero perceived now as an MLS player? He's no longer a designated player, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly came much more affordable than he was those last couple of years.
So he's kind of like a, I don't want to use the term journeyman because I think he's better than that, but he's almost like as much as a striker can be a role player.
Yeah, I mean, he's just transitioning into a different stage of his career. I mean, I think, you know, similar, probably a little ahead of where Will Bruin has been the last couple of years, where he comes in and is just a real threat off the bench. Like, I think Montero will probably play a bit more than that, but you know, that same kind of thing where when you want to change the game off the bench, or if you want to play two forwards up top, those are the options you have now.
And is the expectation that Montero will be starting or coming off the bench, like you're saying?
I think a mix of both. Possibly, depending on the matchup, depending on who else is healthy. And then I think depending on which of the Sounders' young players on the wing step forward. I mean, that's a big question mark here. They've got a number of these talented teenagers, in most cases, who have been, you know, at times in the mix, but haven't really stepped forward to solidify a starting spot because Brian Schmetzer has tended to favor playing veterans in those spots. So you've got Ethan Dobelaire, who looked impressive at the end of last season. Danny Leyva, who was so exciting when he, you know, started to play as at age like 16 in 2019, but was hit by injuries last year. So there's a few different players like that in the mix. And if one of them steps forward, maybe Montero's role is not as big as we were envisioning.
All right. I just want to see Freddie Montero, though.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exciting to have him back. Oh, well, rain news. The NWSL announced the schedule for this year's season opening Challenge Cup, which in opposition to last year's campus bubble setting will be played on in home venues this year. The five teams in each conference will play each other one time in a round robin format. The first match for the Reign on Friday, April 16th, as they host the Houston Dash, and the schedule will wrap up Sunday, May 2nd, with the final the following Saturday.
Now, is this something that NWSL has done before last season, where they have a tournament at any point? So they're just basically saying, this is a thing we're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, they got good enough results in terms of viewership and everything like that. Although it certainly helped that no one else was playing sports at the time the NWSL Challenge Cup kicked off last year. It was definitely like the first sporty event I'd watched in months, live sporty event. It was lots of old Seahawks games. But there was enough excitement about it that they wanted to make it a permanent thing. And, you know, obviously it's somewhat similar to the cup competitions that are always happening during the midst of the MLS season.
They should have an all-tournament season.
What if they made the whole season out of tournaments?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what they did last year.
People love tournaments, no matter the stakes.
People do love tournaments. Look, single elimination soccer matches are always the best. We know that. No ties.
It's like European soccer gets it wrong by not having a playoff tournament at the end of the year, but they get it right by having a bunch of tournaments throughout the year.
Yes. News from the Seattle Storm, who revealed a new logo last week after 21 seasons with the original one. They did have one change, adjusting the team colors in 2016 when they removed the red that the Sonics had previously ditched in 2001, which not long after the Storm inherited that from them when they debuted in 2000, and then swapping out gold for more of a neon yellow. They're maintaining those two colors and adding a neon bolt green to go with them that is, I would say, somewhat Seahawks-esque. So very similar to the action green for the Seahawks.
Where can I see this? Where is this new logo?
You could go to storm.wnba.com. That would probably be a good place to start. You could type Seattle Storm logo into Google. I don't know. There's lots of options here. I assumed you had seen it by this point.
That's a pretty cool logo.
Interesting. You're a fan. It's not my favorite.
It's just a drastic difference from where they were at before.
I don't love the font, I gotta say, on this one. And then I did take note of this. Timbers owner Merritt Paulson joked on Twitter, have the Sonics logo and the Timbers logo been dating? And there's definitely some overlap.
I could see it. It's the Timbers font, right?
I don't think it's quite the same font. It's definitely a very different font.
You could get some Timbers vibes from it. We'll just get
it's really
to
like
it.
The yellow lines are very similar to the what's in the Timbers logo. And the other thing that bugs me is the top of it is supposed to reflect Mount Rainier. It's like the intersection of Mount Rainier, a basketball, and then you've got the Space Needle, which has to be part of the logo.
Uh-huh.
And there's no... You can't actually tell that it's a mountain. It just looks like, you know, a point.
Yeah, no, that does not look at all like you saying that is the first that I would have considered that. Look, if you want to see a mountain in a logo, look no further than the Peltoncast logo, who invented that idea.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't, the Sonics logo that you have behind you, it doesn't look all that different than that one. And the one that you have there does not have the Space Needle in it. And I guess what I'm saying is it really highlights the Space Needle.
It does. I think that's good. I think that's definitely a positive. And there's some of the versions of the logo, like there's a black hoodie that they have that has, you know, doesn't have the team name. It's just got kind of the inner part of the logo, and it's got it in that bolt green. And that does look pretty good. Also, you know, as a middle-aged guy, I don't know that I should be speaking on what looks good or not. I'm not the target demographic.
No, but it looks a little bit graphic designy, you know? And I think the one thing that you want to avoid with any sort of like branding or artwork is you don't want to feel the graphic designness of it. And I can sort of get the sense that you're like, yeah, they hired a graphic design team to do this or whatever. And you can feel that. And that's not something, when you look at like the classic Sonics logo with a skyline, like that does not, it doesn't feel like it was made by a, marketing institution or something, you know, like this sort of feels like a lot of people out of a lot of ideas that were shoved into it. But the highlighting the space, you know, I think is the most important thing.
Yep. Good as always for the space, you know. Mentioned earlier, UW softball, the honors that players won last week. They swept the three-game series at Hawaii by a combined 30-6 score with a pair of run rule games. Currently ranked 8th in the ESPN.com USA Softball Top 25, up one spot from last week when they had dropped to 9th. The Huskies return to Seattle this weekend for their first home games since the NCAA Super Regionals in May 2019. They were set to open the 2020 home schedule on March 12th when they were going to host the USA softball team ahead of the Olympics, and obviously that got canceled. They'll host Portland State and Seattle U in the Husky Classic this weekend. And also the last time the Huskies played here, we went to the game on the Friday night.
Wow. That
seems like forever
ago. So long ago.
So long ago.
How many children have I had since then?
Oh, like 7 or 8, I think.
Jesus.
UW women's basketball season concluded last week in the Pac-12 tournament. Huskies got an impressive 68-54 win Wednesday against 6-seed Colorado, pulling the upset and presumably knocking the Buffaloes, who had been on the bubble, off of it, behind 18 points and 8 assists from Tamia Sadler and 18 points from Haley Van Dyke. Van Dyke then left Thursday's game against number 3-seed UCLA after a collision. Huskies acquitted themselves well versus the nation's number 9 team, but were eliminated with a 58-46 loss. As we look ahead, there's the reason for hope in 2021-22 is Jody Wynn signed a recruiting class ranked number 17 by ESPNW, including 4 top 100 recruits. It's the 5th best ranked recruiting class in the Pac-12 by ESPNW.
That's good God.
Yeah, Pac-12 women's basketball is no joke. No joke. One of those recruits, Jess Finney, enrolled midseason and saw action in more than 10 games. So she got her feet wet a little bit. It's going to be a really big year. I think it's probably a make or break year for the Huskies to show progress under Jody Wynn, who has 2 years left on the 6-year deal she signed to replace Mike Nabors in 2017. You had the promise that Sadler showed, especially early this season as a freshman. You add in the newcomers next year. And, you know, I don't think that getting to the middle of the Pac-12 is realistic just because, again, the conference is so tough and so deep. But you certainly got to be more competitive, I think, than you have been so far under Jody Wynn. You know, be competitive with some of the top teams, win a game again in the Pac-12 tournament, and then you start to feel like you're building something going forward. But maybe more hope for the future than the men's basketball program.
Oh, boy.
You know, men's basketball, after the bye week last weekend, preparing to open the Pac-12 tournament on Wednesday against Utah at 4 p.m. Huskies beat Utah 83-79 at Heckhead in January after a 76-62 loss in Salt Lake City in December that wasn't as close as the final score. It was a hard luck 8th place finish in the Pac-12 standings for the Utes, who had a positive net rating in conference play, but went 8-11 largely because they were 2-4 in games decided by 5 points or fewer. Also boosted that net rating by crushing Arizona State by 39 at home last Saturday without starting point guard Rylan Jones due to a shoulder injury. Unclear if he'll play against the Huskies. KenPom gives the Huskies a 22% chance of extending their season. If they advance, they'd face number 2-seed USC on Thursday.
Let's go.
We actually had a lot of hope this time last year entering the Huskies Pac-12 tournament opener because they had just beaten Arizona and Arizona State in the desert and then played Arizona again. But their season came to an end on the final day of basketball in 2020.
They missed it by one day of never having to say that they missed the tournament.
Cougs were still alive for the NCAA championship in 2020.
You know, we'll see what happens. I guess I wouldn't be shocked if they beat Utah tomorrow. Are they going to go on a miraculous run and win the Pac-12 tournament?
I'm going to rule that one out.
It's within your any chance rule.
It's not. That's outside of my any chance rule. I haven't seen KenPom hasn't posted.
I thought your any chance rule was does something have any chance? Yes, of course. If people are like, does this have any chance of happening? The answer is always yes. In the same way that you were saying, there's always room for improvement no matter what you're doing.
Well, maybe there's room for improvement in the any chance rule.
There's literally always room for improvement, no matter what it is.
I mean, you can't improve Gonzaga's win percentage. I guess that's something that can't be improved. By the way, speaking of undefeated basketball teams in college basketball.
Hello.
Let's revisit 2003-04. Oh. We're actually remembering. We're full on fucking remembering 2003-04 this week. Because I for sure remember these games. As the Huskies wrapped up the Pac-10 regular season by hosting the Bay Area team starting on Thursday with Cal. The Huskies opened that game missing their first 10 shots, but still led 28-20 at halftime before pulling away in the second half for a 76-58 win. My strongest memory of this game is being in the dog pack and participating in We Want Stanford chants in so the late good. Stages of this game.
God.
So we haven't talked yet about the Cardinal because they beat the Huskies in Palo Alto during UW's 0-5 start to conference play that was not part of Let's Revisit 2003-04. But Stanford moved to 26-0 with an off-balance Matt Lodick game winner from 25 feet at Wazoo on that same night, Thursday, coming back from down 5 with under 20 seconds left, thanks in large part to a 4-point play by Dan Grunfeld. And in my memory of this, and this is a good example of why memory is flawed, I remember us finding out that Stanford had narrowly won this game while we were sitting in the dog pack and being excited about that. But according to the Seattle Times and Bob Condotta's game story, Husky players watched the finish in the locker room where they celebrated the Cardinal victory. Apparently like an excited celebration as if they themselves had won a game. And Nate Robinson said, for our team and for everyone here, we deserve it.
Wow. We deserve it. The chance at Stanford. I love where you're like, I consulted Bob Condotta. He said, Kevin Pelton did not watch this game. In the stands or whatever.
I just misremember it. So Stanford was led by...
Let's misremember some years.
Well, I mean, that's a big part of remembering, is understanding how faulty our memory truly is.
Oh, wow.
So Stanford was led by 2004 lottery pick Josh Childress. Matt Lodick was the team's second leading scorer, but more of a volume scorer for my money. Point guard Chris Hernandez. Chris Hernandez, who was number 8 in the nation in true shooting percentage, was their most dangerous player. By the way, fun fact, do you know where Chris Hernandez now works?
How would I know where Chris Hernandez now works?
I you wouldn't. Amazon Web Services. He works in Seattle.
Oh,
site of some of his worst memories. Stanford ranked number 5 in adjusted defensive efficiency, holding opponents to 41% two-point shooting in what would be Mike Montgomery's last year on the farm. They beat number 1 Kansas and Anaheim and number 13 Gonzaga at Oracle Arena in non-conference play, moving into the top 10, then moved up to number 1 in the February 16th AP polls. Survived a few scares in Pac-10 play with 2 buzzer-beating threes, obviously the Lodick one, and the other in a tie game against Arizona by Nick Robinson from 40 feet. Really quite a memorable one.
I kind of remember that game. Yeah, man.
They were looking to become the first team in Pac-10 history to go 18-0 in conference play. So, as we'll talk about in a second, this game is on YouTube in its entirety. The wow. ABC broadcast with Brent Musburger and Jimmy Dykes on the call. And I viewed, I did not get the last minute and a half because you were ready to record earlier than I thought you were going to be. But I reviewed the tapes. It was quite a fun watch. So my number one memory of this game is... going there on the Saturday morning. It was a Saturday afternoon game. It was a pretty nice Saturday in early March in Seattle. And just being shocked to see that there were so many people in line to get in student tickets. It was the first time anyone had ever camped out. You know, this was a thing that happened at Duke with Krzyzewskiville. It wasn't a thing that happened at UW. Like that Cal game, I was in the dog pack and I probably rolled up like 5 minutes before tip off because that was just what you did because this was my senior year. I had been going to games for 4 years. No one had really cared that entire 4 years. And then all of a sudden, my very last weekend of attending games at UW, people started caring.
That's kind of hilarious, actually. This was when the dog pack became a thing.
Like, without question,
this second half of the season was when the dog pack became important. And you know,
not even the second half, just this weekend.
This weekend, this was the weekend that the dog pack became a thing, and that continued for a pretty long time. And I would assume now that you probably still can't roll up just before the game starts and have like a great scene in the dog pack. I think there's still a bit of a legacy from this era that continues decades later. But when I was going to school at UW a handful of years after this, we could not have done. I sat in the dog pack only a couple of times, you know, because I was unwilling to go as early as you needed to go sit in the dog pack. And because I loved sitting in the bleachers anyway, right? I was used to it from Sonics games. Look, I'd been there.
I did the same thing, even though there weren't people in the dog pack. I would occasionally just sit up and so I could spread out in the upper reaches and watch from similar vantage point to
look,
the Sonics games.
You can view the game better. But There were only a couple of games that I went to sitting in the dog pack, you know, during, say, Brandon Roy's junior season, right? But this was the weekend.
Senior season.
I'm talking about his junior year. But, I mean, both of those years were important. But there was only, I don't think I ever sat in the dog pack in a senior year. Maybe one game. That Nick Young game, I sat in the dog pack. And it was because I had to.
His junior year.
Oh, was it his senior year that I was a student?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, well then.
Let's remember when Tristan went to college.
Well, anyway, this is less interesting than the Amazon Web Services conversation you deleted. But the... I only sat in the dog pack a handful of times because it was difficult, right? And it started, like you're saying, this weekend. This was when all attention happened around. And there are these moments in Seattle sports when it's like, that's when the fan base was built. And I do think that there are some remnants of it. People are not paying that much attention to UW basketball in this moment. But I think there is a generation of kids who grew up becoming UW basketball fans starting at this very moment. And I think there are moments with the Seahawks that you can look at, you know, maybe a little bit of lingering during like the Holmgren era, but starting, I think we can pinpoint it like the Beastquake, someplace like that.
I think it's more the Holmgren era. I think it's more the run to the Super Bowl in 2005-06.
And for the Mariners, it's like the second half of 95, right? When they got hot in 95, really the entire fan base that exists for the Mariners exists because of, you can trace it all the way back to the second half of the 1995 season. And I think that's the case with UW men's basketball. Every bit of fan base that exists for UW men's basketball can be traced back to this weekend in March playing against undefeated Stanford in 2004.
All right. So eventually I did make it into the bleachers. And
yeah. Tell me about being there. What was the atmosphere like?
I remember standing the entire time. I mean, it was thrilling for me because it's how I want to watch a game, like standing the entire time, screaming on defense, like the things we want to do at UW football games as well. And that we have to stand in the sit in the last row so that we don't bother anyone with our standing all game. Because not everyone is as engaged in it as we are. So it's just like so exciting to be part of a crowd where everyone had this goal of making an impact on the game. That's one of the things that stands out. The other thing I remember is like after this game, I didn't take advantage of the UW concessions at Heck Ed at all. So I was like so thirsty by the time I got home after I think riding the bus home. Maybe I walked back to Wallingford and going to the corner store that was right up the street from the house that the famous cousin Katie and
darn
I were
good.
Living in at the time.
Darn good
and,
grocery, right?
Getting a great Gatorade and just smashing it so fast because I was so dehydrated after not having anything to drink for like 4 hours and screaming that entire time.
There's
not a thing I could do now.
So much synergy with all the things that we previously talked about that you just mentioned right there. You wove in everything. Also, it's just like, if you want to know why we're not baseball fans, your description of this is how I want to watch a game, which is standing and being excited for every single moment of it. I do think that there's two ways to view a sporting event. I don't think the middle can meet. Is you're either completely checked out and you're having a conversation the entire time, which is a very fun way to watch a sporting event, which is sort of like you're watching a thing happen in front of you, but mentally you're somewhere else. It's like there is a thing happening. And it's like, oh, that's nice when there's a hit or a home run or whatever. But like you're
it's like having it on the background.
Yeah, and you're more consumed by the conversation that you're having, which is a great way to view things. Conversations are excellent. I love them. Or you need to be 100%
Thanks for making the case for conversations.
Really like it. I mean, connecting with people, you know what I mean? Being around human beings in person just really would. Oh, God.
I mean, there were so many people in the stands in 2004. It was very odd watching like people just jam together, including knowing that I myself was in there. By the way, they had a shot of the section I'm certain I was in on the ABC broadcast, but unfortunately the graphic resolution on the YouTube version of this game from 2004 is not high enough to pick out the individual white guys from each other.
100% white, right? Oh, Lord.
There was a lot of candidates. I was like, that could be me, or it could be there, or oh, no, it could be there. They all kind of look like me.
Just find the middle part.
The other funny thing, by the way, is I just said that the way I want to watch games is, again, not high enough resolution, that I want to be like yelling and engaged in the game the entire time, and I work as a sports journalist where you're not allowed to do
really
any of that.
You really fucked up at that one.
You know, so I feel like that's the third way to watch a game. I'm very engaged, but there's very little yelling
you're
when
yelling
I watch a game
inside.
Now.
You're yelling on the inside. You can feel it. Getting stewing and getting furious on the inside. That's your other way of watching a game.
Sometimes I'm yelling in our chat when I'm watching a game.
Taking out your anger on people over other things.
I feel like the anger is usually getting taken out on me. I don't think it's me taking out the anger, usually.
Oh, Lord.
So anyways, my observations from this game. So it was senior day for Curtis Allen, the only senior, the only person who was left from the incoming recruiting class that coincided with him. And I started at UW, which also included CJ Massengale. And I don't know if there was a third person in there who transferred.
Was that a Romar recruiting class, or did he inherit that class?
He inherited. That was Bob Bender. By the way, these guys were in the same year.
This is not like a coach, like Coach Pete Whitting with Coach Sark's players type of thing. He inherited Curtis Allen and CJ Massengale.
No.
You just said that like, hey, that was Bob Bender who recruited Curtis Allen. Like Curtis Allen
was just
great
factual.
Player. Yeah. What is Curtis Allen doing right now, by the way?
I think he might be on Loro's staff at this point.
Oh, really? Because he was a coach at Portland State, wasn't he?
At Wazoo, he was working for Ken Bone.
Ah, okay. Oh, so did he work with Ken Bone in Portland and then move to Wazoo with Ken Bone?
No, he worked for Ken Bone when Ken Bone was the coach at UW. That was their connection.
Oh, okay.
He was the assistant coach. He was on the bench. Also on the bench. I had completely forgotten this until I saw it in the video. Rush Shaney, prominent figure in NBA statistical analysis because of me, was on the bench as an assistant to Lorenzo Romar at that point. Curtis Allen is indeed an assistant to Lorenzo Romar at Pepperdine. They gave BYU a really good run in the West Coast Conference semifinals before losing their good season for Pepperdine. Certainly much better than UW's. Anyways.
Just have to slide that in.
Yeah, just got to remind people. Huskies entered this game with a number 90 RPI, according to the ABC broadcast. And at that point, the lowest RPI ever for an at-large pick was number 74. So there was clearly a lot of urgency for the Huskies to win this game, despite the hot streak that they were on. It was a bit of a slow start as they trailed 11-7 after 5 minutes. They then took the lead for good at 16-15 on a Trey Simmons three-pointer. The Huskies forced 13 first-half turnovers and limited Stanford to 25 points, taking a 10-point lead to the locker room. But then a really shaky start to the second half saw the Huskies go scoreless for the first 6 minutes and 7 seconds as the Cardinal went on an 11-0 run to get within one. Huskies then regained control of this. A bunch of huge threes by Trey Simmons midway through the second half. It was Chris Hernandez who was keeping Stanford in the game. Like, Chris Hernandez, to me, is like the John Stockton of those Stanford teams, or like is Stockton was to us as Sonics fans. That's what Chris Hernandez was to us as UW fans, because like he didn't get a lot of attention, not as much attention as Loddick, who was not nearly as effective, but he was just a killer. And if you want to be safe, if you watch this game, do not play a drinking game every time Brent Musburger and Jimmy Dykes refer to Chris Hernandez as tough, because you're going to be in trouble. Brandon Roy was quiet most of the game, but then got big buckets late, And the Huskies just kind of arm's length Stanford a little bit down the stretch of this one, I would say, to come up with the victory, 75-62. They pulled away late at the free throw line. And it was the second win over a number one team in UW men's basketball history, the other coming against UCLA with Romar as a player in that
game. Wow, look at that.
Yeah. Yeah, they had some good footage of that one on the broadcast. That was fun.
And that's never happened since, correct?
I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I mean, playing the Pac-12, you don't get that many opportunities.
Not these days, no. There were more back in that era. So the crowd obviously stormed the court. Now, the other thing that stands out in my memory of this is, obviously, I was having no part of that.
I wish that,
I really
that there was
the opportunity to from the bleachers.
They were showing the fans, and every single person from the dog pack was on the court except for you. That would be an iconic moment.
Again, I wasn't in the dog pack, so it wouldn't quite have worked like that. But yes, that would have been great.
Wait, did you say you weren't in the dog pack? I thought you said that you were.
I said I was on Thursday. I got in, rolled up 5 minutes late. But Saturday, I was up in the bleachers in front of the windows.
It would have been even better if every single person in the stadium would have been on the court and you were in the bleachers alone.
I don't know if you could have fit all 10,000 on the court, but oh, man, thinking of the transmission there. Oh, it's real bad. No, there was not a lot of 6 feet of separation. So, I mean, it's my favorite basketball game I've ever attended. I've attended some pretty amazing games. Game 7 of the 2016 finals, like one of the biggest games.
There's no stakes,
in
though. You didn't care who won.
Sure. But there's games that I've had stakes for, like Storm games where they won the championship, things like that. I mean, the 2018 Game 5 of the Western Conference Finals where Sue Bird went off in the fourth quarter and, you know, Diana Taurasi, the first ever loss for her in an elimination game in the WNBA playoffs. Like, that's another one that's real memorable. But this to be, you know, again, to have the culmination of that season, the turnaround of the basketball team in my time at UW, beating an undefeated number one team. I don't know that one's ever getting topped. Maybe if the Sonics win a championship.
A lot of things need to happen before then.
So many things, yeah.
That's an interesting question. I feel like my favorite basketball game, I don't know. There's a handful that I remember really well, feel very strongly about, but being able to pinpoint it, I mean, I feel like I was too young for that Game 7 against the Jazz to go to the finals. Like, I have some vague memories of it, but I was still, especially now having a child who's almost that age, a small child when that happened, you know? But
yeah, I guess that's true.
I was fixing the brakes on my car, on my Chevy Lumina, with our cousin Chris, who was a student at UW at the time, right?
Yes.
Who I don't know why he wasn't at this game. I think just an oversight.
Where was the famous cousin Katie?
Bandwagon fans. They weren't there with you in the David Dixon era. Dennis Dixon?
Dennis Dixon, yes.
Dennis Dixon. You fucking don't come out here and vote for Katie for Peltoncast MVP every single year. She couldn't be bothered to get season tickets for any of the years. What?
Dennis Dixon was the quarterback. David Dixon is the
I had it right center. The first time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Messed you up.
Katie couldn't be bothered to get Husky basketball tickets until the team was good. The next year she had Husky basketball tickets. Anyway.
Wow. Really trying to improve your rating by taking on the famous cousin Katie is not a good idea.
I will do it anytime. If Katie were here, I'd do it to her face.
I mean, you wouldn't do it to her face because we're keeping the you would do it over Zoom.
That's to her face over Zoom. But I remember watching this game and just being nervous the entire time, but also weirdly confident going into it. And I think that sort of, like you mentioned, the chance of we want Stanford on that Thursday night. The Huskies were maybe probably a better team than Stanford was. You know, it's not unheard of that they were a better team.
But home court advantage is such a big advantage in college basketball that it was reasonable to think that they could win this game.
The Stanford team that you were talking about, when you mentioned those names, and obviously Josh Childress was a very good player and is remembered worse because he was a bust in the NBA. But like, there were a lot of players.
He was a bust in the NBA. I mean, he was a good player in Atlanta. It was only after he came back from Greece that he wasn't any good.
Okay.
I mean, it was a, I don't know if you remember this, it was a very strange story where there was an off season where it was like there's not much money in free agency, and Childress got the bag from to play in Greece, and it was like, oh, this is going to be a trend. All these guys are going to leave the NBA to play in Europe, and then no, that didn't happen. It was just John Childress.
Most of the things that people think are going to be trends, this is just an overall life thing. If there's something that pops up out of nowhere and you're like, wow, this goes against 40 years of history, and you're like, that's going to be a trend, the answer is it's not going to be a trend. Bet against the thing that's brand new coming out of nowhere being a trend versus the shit that's happened for the previous 40 years. But anyway, that's an aside.
It's called regression to the mean.
As you're investing in NFTs right now, just think about the previous history. It's fine. But it's not that impressive sounding of a team, right? There are some names. I'm like, surely Mark Madsen was on this team, right? Surely Brook and Robin Lopez were on this team. And there are so many Stanford greats from this time period who weren't on this team. You know, Matt Loddick and Josh Childress, like that, they didn't have... They weren't like a legendary Pac-12 team in as much as they just happened to win a lot of games.
I mean, they were experienced and they were well coached, and you know, they played to their strengths, knew the system, all of those cliches about a team, and then they got kind of lucky in a bunch of close games. So we'll revisit. We'll have lots more on Stanford to come in. Let's revisit a season, because wow, this was really not the last matchup between the Huskies.
We're gonna have some Kirk Snyder remembering happening.
Oh, you're fucking A right. We're gonna remember Kirk Snyder, because I was at those games too.
Your favorite games you've ever been to. Anyway, such an important moment for the UW men's basketball program. And you can pinpoint pretty much everything back to this game, and I think that's huge.
I hope we have another moment like it again sometime in the future. So the reason I knew this was on YouTube is that the listener at GoHuskies1978 tweeted us a few weeks back that someone had posted it. And he said, such a good game, fun team. Mike Jensen is fabulous in this game. Have I forgotten how good and integral he was to these teams? Has the UConn screw up caused me to unfairly remember his career? Big questions.
And?
So I reviewed the Mike Jensen statistical record. I think part of it is that Jensen is probably unfairly remembered both for the combination of the UConn game. I mean, that was his last game as a Husky. And the fact that he was a big man playing on the perimeter in an era where you were considered soft if you did that. And we didn't realize, like, hey, it's actually great that the Huskies are playing this five-out system long before anyone realizes that that's a thing. Like, I remember... even myself feeling that way at times about Sam Perkins and his Seattle days, like, why is he shooting so many threes, and not realizing the spacing benefit that it provided. Like, Jensen wasn't that kind of a shooter. But the other thing that I hadn't really remembered before I revisited Jensen's career is that this was basically his best season. This was his redshirt sophomore year, and it kind of went downhill in many ways from that. It was his most efficient season. It was his best season from three-point range. He he did technically shoot a better percentage as a redshirt freshman, but he made 24 threes at a 41% clip this year, 49% of his two-point attempts. And I had forgotten this. He only started 12 games his senior year, the 24 he played. And there must have been some injuries in there that I'm not remembering. But it was also his freshman year was the most minutes he played. This was the second most at 23.4, his highest scoring season. So I think that's part of it too, that this version of Mike Jensen was a little better than the one we saw the next 2 years.
I'm kind of shocked by that. I remember, you know, Mike Jensen, I think like you're describing, he was always kind of like a tortured figure in UW men's basketball history, where it was like you just wanted him to do well, and he would have occasional moments and glimpses, and he would knock down a three every once in a while. I'd be like, yes, Mike Jensen, there we go. But not somebody who was, you know, the rest of the players on these teams were too good. And exactly. I think it made Mike Jensen look worse, right? Like, there was just so much talent that was within the program during this kind of like 4-year era.
I mean, the other starters on that team all played in the NBA. All were, you know, other than Will Conway, were drafted. You had 2 first-round picks. One of them an all-star, one of them a dunk champion who's played a long time in the league. Bobby Jones is still playing internationally. Trace Simmons had an extremely long international career. Yes, by comparison to them, Mike Jensen wasn't as good. That's not really a knock on him. That's just that this was this amazingly talented team. Jensen, the second highest recruiting rating of the players on the 2004 Huskies. Nate Robinson, because of the bias against undersized guards and maybe because people thought he was going to play football, not a top 100 recruit. The top 100 recruits on the team were Roy, number 45, according to the consensus, Jensen, number 90 the year before, and Bobby Jones, number 97. So
remember that when you're pouring over recruiting rankings.
Don't matter that much for individuals.
And Brandon Roy's maybe the most skilled basketball player I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much his academics were a part of that, but he also wasn't that player
his
in
academics,
high school.
His academics? You think they would lower him to 45 because of his academics? Have you ever seen Brandon Roy shoot a jumper? God. Anyway, there's no going back once you've run with the pack.
Oh, had that poster in my room a very long time.
I'm sure it's still hanging in my childhood bedroom. On the ceiling. It's like Darth Maul right next to Curtis Allen.
Yeah, Curtis Allen is most prominent because you got to feature the senior. UW football, the 2021 schedule is out. The Huskies are scheduled to visit Michigan in week 2 in between home matchups with Montana and Arkansas State. They'll open the Pac-12 schedule by hosting Cal. Bye comes in October 9th in week 6. Huskies will play a Friday night matchup in the desert on October 22nd at Arizona as part of a 2-game road trip that also takes them to Stanford, and then 3 of their last 4 games at home, including Oregon, Arizona State, and the Apple Cup against Washington State.
Okay. Do you have enough comments on a schedule?
I don't know. It's nice to see a schedule, I guess.
Okay.
Something. Some disappointing news is sophomore wide receiver Puka Nacua announced his transfer to BYU along with his older brother Samson, who previously played at Utah. In an interview with KJR on Monday, Nacua explained that, you know, well, this wasn't how he wanted his UW career to end. He felt like he needed to be close to home to help his mother and grandmother. The Nacuas are from Orem, just outside Provo. Nacua played just 11 games at UW due to injuries and missing the final game of 2020 after contracting COVID-19, as he confirmed on KJR. He ranked 2nd on the team with 9.4 expected points added as a receiver in 2020, playing 3 of the 4 games. Huskies would return just one of their top 3 targets, receivers by targets now, with Ty Jones already having announced his transfer. That's Terrell Bynum, who's the one who's left as a returning starter wide receiver with a bunch of youth behind him. Redshirt freshman Jalen McMillan, Rube Dunze, and Sawyer Racanelli figure to be high on the depth chart, along with Texas Tech transfer Jalen Polk will come in as a redshirt freshman, and incoming freshman Jebez Tenay.
So. Still a position UW football has had a bit of a hard time figuring out long term, and having a bunch of wide receiver depth. I mean, this class that you're talking about, which was Puka Nacua and Ty Jones and folks like that, just never really, you know, they probably, this would have been their year that they would have played well, but didn't really have the opportunity to. And now it's kind of, we're moving on to the next generation of wide receivers.
Yeah. And they're highly touted players. Many of these were, you know, 4-star prospects. So there's certainly talent still, but just not a lot of proven experience that you would want at that position. And, you know, the big thing is hoping that, the Nacuas, everything goes well for them and their family, and exciting, I'm sure, for the two of the brothers to have the chance to play together in what will be Samson's final year of eligibility. Let's wrap up with the Seahawks as they prepare for free agency. As the 2021 NFL salary cap gets set, the Seahawks released defensive end Carlos Dunlap. As part of negotiation at the time of his trade to Seattle last fall, Dunlap got a $3 million roster bonus due March 22nd that essentially triggered a situation where he would either have his contract renegotiated or be released. Because of the fact that the Seahawks acquired him via trade, there's no dead money on their cap, so they clear $14 million in room, but now must compete with other teams to re-sign Dunlap, whose arrival invigorated their pass rush at midseason. I mean, I don't know that this is necessarily goodbye for Dunlap, but he did tweet, still grateful, thank you Seahawks, into the 12. So it didn't sound very much like he's planning on coming back. I mean, we'll see what the market pairs for him, I guess.
I mean, you have to approach this, if you're Carlos Dunlap, as if you've just been released, right? Like, you can't be like, I will be back, right?
He was part of this process, surely. Like, they were ongoing conversations between him and the team. It wasn't like they just, you know, came out of nowhere and released
him. He's going into free agency, though. You don't want to give up too much. Have you never negotiated anything? You don't want to be like, yeah, I'm clearly going back here. You want to see what's out there, right? You want to see what kind of offers are available to you if you're Carlos Dunlap. And I'll be very
fascinated. That just sounded a lot like a farewell message. There's a difference between what happens and a farewell message.
I wouldn't take that much away from this.
Okay. How much are we taking away from the Seahawks not mentioning Russell Wilson in their letter to season ticket holders?
Oh, God. Did they not? Did they mention other players?
They mentioned DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. Those are the only players that were mentioned.
It was a season ticket holder. I got none of this. Where's...
Yeah, I don't... I guess Chris got it.
I went to Chris.
They mentioned them in the context of, quote, record-setting seasons, which I guess Russell Wilson set records too, so he probably should have been mentioned, but I don't think it's like, oh, it's a sign they're going to trade him. Also, the only team that really made sense to trade him to, they just extended their quarterback. So, Dak Prescott, I don't know if you heard that contract.
But it was the Cowboys weren't on the list, though.
They were on the list.
Oh, were they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well.
And they were the only team that could, you know, send the Seahawks a quarterback, so... Sorry, Derek Carr.
Wow. I don't know if I'm taking too much away from this Carlos Dunlap news. It'll be very interesting to see what the market is like for Dunlap, I'll say. And I don't think it would be unheard of for him not to find a robust market for his services right now. And there's a good chance that, and I think this is what the Seahawks were betting on, was he had a half season in Seattle in this program, seemed to like it for what it's worth. And if dollars to dollars are the same with other offers that he has out there, there's a good chance that he comes back.
Yeah, I mean, especially given that the teams that have a lot of cap space are teams that were not good last season, whereas the rest of, you know, successful teams like the Seahawks are going to be struggling to deal with this reduced cap. And then there's also going to be a lot more free agents on the market because of that, because guys are going to get released. So it's going to be an interesting free agency for a lot of people, including some of the Seahawks' other free agents.
When, you know, I think they ended up looking at the Jadeveon Clowney situation last year, which, you know, it could have gone totally different if he was in Seattle. But I don't think there was a point throughout the season that the Seahawks regretted not re-signing Jadeveon Clowney, you know, or not getting to the number that...
I mean, Clowney did not play particularly well and dealt with injuries, which I'm sure was a factor in what the Seahawks did. But, you know, also they did have a disastrously terrible pass rush in the first half of the season. So I feel like you had to have some regrets there.
They had regrets about the pass rush in particular, but there's, you know, so much that you're going to pay for one player, right? Like I think that individual.
Yeah, you pay it for a safety who you use as a pass rusher. Mistakes were made.
But not re-signing Jadeveon Clowney was not one of those mistakes. Mistakes were made, sure. Mistakes have been made over and over and over again. I don't think that this is it. And I don't think releasing Carlos Dunlap is a mistake either. This was the right decision. This is right process. They're looking at a player like Carlos Dunlap, as he is very valuable if you can get him on the right contract. This wasn't the right contract, though. They don't need to overpay Carlos Dunlap.
I mean, it's impossible to really know whether it was a good decision because we don't know what offers they made to him is a renegotiation and, you know, that he evidently rejected. So we don't have enough information to say whether it's a good or bad decision, but they've got a lot of guys to re-sign and now they've got to figure out defensive end as part of that too.
I guess so. But they also have more money to re-sign those players.
Sure. I mean, he wasn't going to be counting $14 million on the cap under any circumstance. We know that. So the Seahawks opted not to use their franchise tag on any of their players. The most likely candidates for that were Shaquille Griffin and Chris Carson, both of whom are among the starters headed to unrestricted free agency for the Seahawks. Legal tampering period opens next Monday. So we're heading quickly towards free agency. And by this time next week, you know, we may know a lot more about who's going to be on the 2021 Seahawks.
Can we call it like conversation period, legal tampering period? It's not tampering. Like there has to be a better term for that.
Obviously there is, but we had the same discussion last year. So we may just want to. Yeah, I re-listened to that pod not long ago. By the way, we were very confident the Seahawks were going to re-sign Clowney at that point.
We thought there was going to be a lot of legal tampering happening. Maybe even some illegal tampering.
Yeah. Let's go through and talk about these free agents a little bit. We talked about them with Ben Baldwin at the end of the season, but I feel like my perspective on how many are going to return is a lot more pessimistic than it was then.
That feels fair.
Also, my outlook on the Seahawks in general is a lot more pessimistic than it was then, because at that point, the quarterback wasn't publicly beefing with the team. So We were parsing season ticket holder letters to try to figure out their meaning. It was a simpler time. Let's start with Shaq.
I still think he'll be back.
I think he's probably the biggest priority for the Seahawks and these guys. There is a fair bit of sentiment out there. Like I've seen Michael Sean Dugar, who we had on last week, who was great, who you should listen to if you haven't listened to that for some reason, that, you know, they should just let Griffin go. He mentioned obviously bringing back Sherman, re-sign Quentin Dunbar in the cheap coming off his knee surgery, and have those guys and DJ Reed and figure it out from there.
That would be a bold move. You'd have to invest money somewhere else. And I think there'd have to be a plan to invest money somewhere else, which maybe there is. You know, maybe the Seahawks are going to come out. We've seen the offensive line free agents, right? And maybe they're just like, fuck it. You want these offensive linemen, Russ? Here you go. Here are your offensive linemen. That could be something that they do. You know, I would be surprised, but I wouldn't be shocked if that was a strategy. And as part of that, Shaquille Griffin has to go. It's probably the best way to approach putting together a football team, if we're being honest. Re-signing Shaquille Griffin is, you know, investing in the secondary is probably wiser than investing in the front seven. But as you've mentioned, mistakes have been made, and they've already invested in the front seven pretty heavily in the last couple of years in the draft in particular. So is there somebody else out there who could play cornerback? Sure. Did Shaquille Griffin have a very good season? Yes. And I still think he's coming back, unless there is a plan in the front office to wholly rethink how they approach football. Then I think Shaquille Griffin is coming back.
The person I'm specifically more pessimistic about is KJ Wright. I feel like he's gone.
Wow. We'll see about the market. I'm not convinced that there's going to be a robust market for KJ Wright.
But all it takes is one.
I could picture KJ Wright in a Raiders uniform. I think they must be in cap hell right now if they're releasing all these players. But like, there's something about
Jets.
You're thinking the Jets for KJ.
Robert Saleh brings him in, veteran mentor. Either him or Sherman. Those are the options for Robert Saleh.
Oh God.
One of the others. There's gonna be some ex Seahawks on the Jets defense next year. It's just a question of which ones. Chris Carson.
I mean, he's obviously gone. Like, unless there's just no market at all for Chris Carson. But the Seahawks drafted a running back in the first round to replace Chris Carson. Like, at some point, you have to just play that running back. And now's the time. You know what I mean? They drafted Rashad Penny to replace Chris Carson when his contract came up. This is it. This is the moment. They invested in Rashad Penny. Rashad Penny is probably good enough to do it if he's healthy. That's a pretty big if. I personally think that to the extent that running backs can have individual ability, Chris Carson has that individual ability, but paying any of those running backs doesn't make sense.
Benson Mayoa?
At the minimum, I don't know.
I think it'd be more than that, but he was fine, but also we saw that he wasn't the guy. He has to be the other guy as a rush end.
He's a depth rush end. Like they're going to be, if they're spending on Benson Mayoa, they should be spending on it late. The Seahawks do things that you shouldn't do as a team, though. So you never fucking know. You know, the Seahawks took their money last offseason and broke it up in $7 million increments and paid it out to a bunch of players, including Benson Mayoa. Who knows what the hell they're going to do?
Ethan Posick, it feels like less likely to come back at this point.
No idea.
When Russell Wilson's complaining about the offensive line, he's not complaining about Dwayne Brown. He's probably not complaining about the right side. Posick and left guard are the positions he's complaining about.
I feel like it's less about individual players than it is about the offensive line as a whole, though. It's not like Russell Wilson doesn't have it out for Ethan Posick. He just wants better offensive linemen.
But that's a spot where they have the ability to upgrade pretty reasonably this year since, you know, he's a free agent and it wasn't a position of strength. And interior offensive line is probably the bigger need for the Seahawks given the players in their division, who, as a reminder, include Aaron Donald and J.J. Watt. And also Nick Bosa, although that's not the interior offensive line. Jacob Hollister is a free agent. I feel like I'd be a bit surprised, although I don't know. The Seahawks seem to think a lot more of Jacob Hollister than I do, so I don't know.
Again, if it was the minimum, sure, re-sign Jacob Hollister. But like, if you're paying Jacob Hollister anything more than that, it is not a good allocation of resources under the current salary cap.
David Moore's probably in a similar situation.
He'll get paid more than the minimum, but yes.
It wouldn't be stunning if someone really valued him and tried to give him a shot in a bigger role. If you like to throw deep passes, for example. Bruce Irvin, coming off the ACL injury. I think he's in that same boat of, you know, if you can get him very cheaply, much more cheaply than last year, would be great to have him back. Otherwise, not a big priority to re-sign.
Absolutely.
You'd probably say the same about Quentin Dunbar.
Quentin Dunbar is an intriguing one, I will say. Quentin Dunbar is more intriguing than almost anybody else in this list because, you know, he didn't have a serious injury like Bruce Irvin had or something like that. Missed a lot of time, but didn't have an injury that was like, you know, this is maybe career threatening. And also it is not as old as Bruce Irvin or something like that is. He's still, you know, a season away from the excellent PFF grade that he had with Washington, right? But there's something there with Quentin Dunbar that I think the Seahawks could see as basically like a buy low type player. He might just need a change of scenery, though, and it might just make sense for Quentin Dunbar to find somewhere else to play. We'll see what the market is like. I think there will be a market for Quentin Dunbar, probably more than there'll be for somebody like Bruce Irvin or Hollister or whatever. But like, if there isn't and he comes back, I think that would be a fine thing as somebody who's competing for one of those cornerback positions.
I mean, the thing here, and this is maybe similar to Clowney, is that the Seahawks are going to know more about the injury than anyone else's, and specifically like how much it compromised his ability to play before he had knee surgery. So their decision to bring him not back or not will tell us what they know to an extent.
I mean, you look at all these free agents, and if every single one of them were on a new team next year, it won't happen. They're going to re-sign some of these players, but it wouldn't be shocking if all of them were gone.
And I mean, there's no one who's 100% to come back, and there's no one who's 100% to go, I think.
Yeah, but a large chunk of them will go.
Yes.
You can't...
if they're all around 50, then by definition, and there's like...
The Seahawks are in a bit of a fortunate place where when you think about importance to the roster, Shaquille Griffin is obviously an important player to the roster as it is constructed right now. You know, we had the conversation with Mike Sean, which was, if Russell Wilson is gone, Shaquille Griffin is basically worthless to you as a team, right? Like, investing in a cornerback is not that big of a deal if you're not going to have Russell Wilson because you're not competing. He pointed out that Pete Carroll doesn't have time for a rebuild. So,
and wouldn't think about it that way in terms of Russell Wilson's value.
Oh God,
I mean, obviously they value Russell Wilson. They keep signing him. They signed him to the largest contract for a quarterback for any player in NFL history. It's not like they think that having, you know, Nick Foles at $6 million is a better choice than Russell Wilson. But they also may not realize how dependent their success has been on Russell Wilson the last few years.
But it'll be interesting to see how they spend their money. You know, they whiffed pretty majorly last offseason on pretty much every free agent signing. And again, just the process for how you're going to make free agent signings. If you were a team where you were just like, we don't make free agent signings, we're not going to be competitive. That's an approach that I can respect. Or if you want to go out there and spend big money, that's another approach. That is, it's a perspective.
I mean, it can work at times, like Green Bay going out and aggressively signing the Smiths to upgrade their pass rush in before the 2019 season, even though their production has been maybe not as good as it looks in terms of the sack numbers and their defense hasn't been that strong. Like, they definitely helped out a weakness for that team.
The idea of bringing in multiple players at a low number, basically, I guess what I'm saying is the difference between Bruce Irvin and a minimum pass rusher is not that great. You know, that replacement level is, Bruce Irvin's pretty close to it. And Benson Mayo is pretty close to it. And the Seahawks have an issue, which is that they are willing to pay their guys that they know a little bit more than they probably should. And every single player that they signed in last offseason, probably more than they should have.
I mean, the thing about free agency is, by definition, the more concerned you are about getting a specific player, the worse deal you're going to get, as opposed to if you have a group of a handful of players that you're okay with, and whoever of them, you know, gets the least interest, that's the one you sign.
I mean, that's where you want to be, right? You want to be at the, if you don't have the money, which the Seahawks don't, to make a splash, so to say, in free agency. You know, I think that there are linemen that are going to be out there, especially because of what you mentioned about the cap staying relatively static this year, right?
I mean, I think it's actually gone down slightly, isn't it?
There was a number that came out earlier today of what the cap is looking like it'll be.
$182.5 million per Pro Football Talk. But I don't know what the 2020 salary cap was.
Now, off the top of your head, what was the 2020 salary cap?
$198.2 million.
Oh, and so what was the number this year?
$182.5 million.
Wow, that is a significant decrease.
Yeah.
So they're going to be linemen out there for the taking. The Seahawks are not going to have a lot of money to go sign those. Neither is any team, though. You know, the market's for these players. These players are free agents in the worst year to be a free agent. So, you know, maybe teams will be able to go out and get some players at numbers that they feel a lot more comfortable with. And maybe you will see a player like, you know, like, is there going to be money for KJ Wright at a salary cap that's $18 million less than it was last year? That's going to be a tough situation. You know, if you're going out and looking at a veteran like that. So, you know, maybe they will be able to bring some players like that back. But I do think it'll be very telling as we head into next week how this money is spent and if they are aggressive with their name being in the mix. They don't have to sign these offensive linemen, but if they're in the mix and it's like the Seahawks are bringing in, you know, Trent Williams or bringing in this player and this player and this player, I think it'll be clear what their priorities are and in this offseason, that they really want to make Russell Wilson happy. If that's not something that's happening, then there's obviously a sign of a much larger issue.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to reconvene in a week and see where we are.
And it's really all that matters. None of this other shit matters. Russell Wilson is it. That's all that matters, as Russell Wilson's happiness with the organization. KJ Wright doesn't matter. Shaquille Griffin doesn't matter. Chris Carson doesn't matter. All that matters is Russell Wilson happy?
I mean, part of what's going to make Russell Wilson happy is if the Seahawks win a lot of football games and are competitive in the playoffs. Like, that's going to make Russell Wilson happy, even if it's not specifically the guys that he thought or even the positions that he thought. If they go to the Super Bowl, like, he's going to be happy. So I do think they matter from that standpoint.
Do you think it ever makes sense to invest in free agency on defense?
I mean, when the Seahawks invested in Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril in free agency on defense. Yeah, I think that made sense. I'm gonna say yes.
Is that investing though?
It was still money they spent on it. I mean, like, they got those guys at bargains, but they still spent part of their salary cap on them.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think you should go like 90% offense, 10% defense. But I don't know that you should go 50-50 either.
What is the right way to allocate those resources if you have a salary cap?
I mean, I'd have to probably look at the historical data a lot more than I have. And the other thing you'd want to account for is the draft resources. You know, that like when you sign a first round, when you draft a first player in the first round at a position, essentially what you're doing is trying to buy their production on that rookie contract for cheaper than it would cost to get that same production in free agency. So you'd want to account for that. But I'd guess the optimal number is probably around 60-40.
Okay.
Setting aside special teams. Okay. Well, legal tampering period. Hate the name. Looking forward to seeing what happens. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.